I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the biggest stories in European football. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Lars Watson.
On this edition, what a week it's been for Italy's top four. It's like 1955 all over again. Also in Germany, what a week it's been for Bayern Munich. 19 pot shots. And they just could not score. Crisis? What crisis? And as we go into the international break, what is the point of the Nations League? Andy and Lars, those are three main topics, but
good
I know,
topics.
Yeah, not bad. But I know you've got other stories that perhaps have caught your eye, Lars.
Well, I kind of want to follow up on the chat you had last week, because you had a very timely Juventus in crisis moment last week.
We aim to please the
listeners. And then they go and lose to Monza. But I mean, it's not getting better, is it? I mean, well, no, because we're going to talk about the title race in Italy, so we're clearly not going to talk about Juventus, which is why I'm bringing it up now. My God, they're not very good, are they, Andy? They're absolutely terrible.
Yeah, they are. They are. As are
French referees, according to people in the wider world. Last weekend, we had what appears to be the joint fastest ever red card. Jean-Claire Todibo, formerly of Barcelona fame, sent off a after nine seconds for a professional foul that I think Dante had it covered, to be perfectly honest.
It was a bit of a diss, wasn't it, from the ref? Looked at Dante, said, "No, you're not making that one." I was like, hang on, I'm old, but I'm not that slow. I was disappointed by this because I saw it on the timeline on the Twitter saying, "Oh, he's off after 9 seconds," thinking, "Yes, this'll be good." And then you watch it and you think, "Oh, come on, no. That is very harsh. Should not have been sent off, I didn't think."
Exactly. And he talked at length about it afterwards, Todibo, and how what was going on with French referees needed looking at. Oscar Garcia, the Rams coach, formerly of Brighton and Watford, of course, talked after his team's defeat against Monaco, most of which they played with 10 men, how people in Spain call him and text him all the time saying, "Why are your referees so bad?" And there are more red cards in France than any other league in Europe's top five, and that's without going into Ligue 2.
Well, with 9 seconds, I suppose there's still time for that record to be beaten.
I'd love to see it, though, if someone just went into a game fully committed. I'm going to make my mark here.
I'm going to
set a record that cannot be beaten. He'll just stand as close to the centre circle as he can and just bolt in and two-foot the fellow who's taking the kickoff. Like, boom, record set, beat that. They'll remember my name forever now.
Let's talk about 1955, though. When it comes to Italy, obviously, Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley and the Comets, for you youngers who don't know, was at the top of the charts, amongst other things. But for Italy, that was the last time four top teams in Italy all lost their matches in the same weekend, and they've just gone and done it again. I mean, it's only, 65 years or so since the last time, 67 years now?
Yeah, you do wonder if it'll be that long again before Milan, Inter, Roma and Juventus all lose on the same weekend. As Lars was saying, the Juventus story, as we went into in great depth with Nicky last week, is remarkable. I don't think any of us sat around and thought while we were recording that Juventus would actually go on to lose at Monza. So that was the biggest surprise.
Angel Di Maria, though, was part of that, wasn't it? Monza wouldn't have won down to 10 men.
It definitely helps.
Yeah.
And
I think this Juventus team are more than capable of losing to Monza with 11 men on the field.
But, I think that is one thing. I think these are all very different cases. Roma, if they played that game against Atalanta another 100 times, I think they'd probably win it 95. You know, they created a lot of chances. I think if you look in the top six or seven, Roma, with all the extra firepower they have, and with everything going through Paulo Dybala, who obviously pulled out with an injury before kickoff, and that probably made a difference. The amount of goals they've scored compared to the offensive power they've got is underwhelming so far. That's something that they can work on. Inter have been absolutely panelled, or their board have absolutely been panelled by the fans after that defeat at Udinese, which is their third of the season already. I think really we've got to start with Milan, because that was the big game last, Milan against Napoli.
Mm.
It felt really close, really well contested. And I don't know, I wanted to ask you, do you believe after this that Napoli, who are now top and have had a start to the season that kind of defies what turbulent summer they had, do you see them as a contender?
I kind of already saw them as a team to look out for, certainly. And
that's a slightly different thing,
isn't it? Yeah, I guess. I mean, AC Milan actually had the better of the chances, I thought, in this game. So Napoli will count themselves slightly lucky in that sense. But I think the big story for me for Napoli is how players who you might not have expected that much from are just stepping up here now. Because obviously, in the summer, the locals were restless. Mertens was let go, Insigne was let go, Koulibaly was let go. Like, really, even some of them are on the wrong end of their careers, maybe, but really towering figures in the sort of recent history of that football club.
Exactly.
And if you look at the players they brought in, they were not big names. You know, the South Korean defender, Min Jae Kim from Turkey, they brought in someone like Raspadori, Kvaratskhelia, Cholito Simeone. Like, these are players who had not proven that they were at that level. But what we're seeing is that they're doing it. I mean, Kvaradona has been a sensation. And, you know, even if he didn't score here, he was really good again. And he's such a fun player just really watch the worth the price of admission on his own sometimes. And you know, Giovanni Simeone is turning up with goals with when Osimhen's not around. Raspadori scored a winner last weekend. So you're just getting really important contributions from players who I think when they were brought in, I suspect quite a few Neapolitans might have been slightly underwhelmed by the idea that we're replacing basically club legends with these guys. But we're already seeing early in the season that those look like good bets from the team's sporting leadership.
They didn't look overwhelmed, did they? At all. They looked like they were championship contenders to me.
No, I think the interesting thing was how Milan came back and equalised, and Giroud in the big games is just fire at the moment. We'll maybe come to his rather more precarious position with France when it comes to the World Cup a bit later on, perhaps. But, you know, he's a banker for Milan at the moment, who, remember, had Rafael Leao out suspended after that, I think it's fair to say, contestable red card as Sampdoria last week. But I think the fact that Napoli composed themselves and came back and got that winner. I mean, when you were saying that they were getting more out of players who you wouldn't necessarily expect I was thinking of the assist, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. A great cross by Mario Rui. And I was like, have we finally Mario Rui tribute episode?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I've been waiting for a long time.
He's been good. Is
a great cross and a really, really terrific header. And you're right, for them to be able to make light of that absence of Osimhen is very impressive. All of a sudden, they look like they have depth.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think that is important because I think over the coming months, Dalton, we can expect more from Simeone. We can expect more from Raspadori. We can expect more from Tanguy Ndombele,
who already
has a Champions League goal to his name this season. Of course, he scored in the game against Rangers. I do kind of think with Ndombele that for him to get back to his absolute best form, he needs to play every single week. And I don't know if that's happening in the medium term, but I think if he can contribute to any sort of level, I mean, he's an absolutely huge boost for them. And going back to where Lars started, Kim has been outstanding so far. That block at the end to make sure they finished off the game, he kind of celebrated it like a goal. You know, he's been absolutely towering so far.
Well, that one question, though, it leads into that. The one question that I would ask, if we're going to talk of Napoli as serious title contenders, what are they like in defence? It's okay to talk about, you know, how they are going forward, but in Italy, to win that Serie A, you've got to have a tight defence.
Yeah, that is, I guess that's less true than it used to be. It's more about scoring the goals because it's a high scoring league now. But they need to not be leaky. I mean, that's definitely important. And I think, you know, you go back to the game that Lars was talking about the weekend before where Raspadori scored right at the end. I think to be able to grind out clean sheets when you're not playing particularly well, Alex Meret looks like he's ready for the succession in goal. But I do think a key player so far this season has been one that has been there. He's in his second season now. Is Andre Frank Zambo and Gisa.
Mm-hmm.
He has been outstanding.
Another
so
really
far
fun player.
Season. He is. And what I think's interesting is you assume that he's the metronome that keeps the team going and he's, you know, a less flashy sort of player. But he's been getting involved in the attacking side. I mean, you know, if you go back to Spalletti's Roma, and I don't know, I'm never someone who had huge pretensions to be a football player or prospects of being so, but I don't often.
I thought you were okay, actually, in midfield.
You had to say that. I lent you my boots.
You did. Thank you.
But I think I used to look at Spalletti's Roma sometimes and think, that looks a fun team to play for. And I'm kind of getting the same feeling about this Napoli.
Yeah, they just have a lot of, like you say, fun is a good word for it. Like, a lot of fun players. And just the prospect of if they could get the enigmatic Tanguy Ndombele fit and firing and close to his full potential. Like, a team that has, like, Zambo Anguissa, who you see him as a metronome. I mean, I'm more like, when you watch his... His overall playing style is a little bit more sort of ball winning. Like, he's got a strong physical stature. He's not afraid to get stuck in. He runs around a lot. But he's a weirdly good dribbler. Whenever you watch him, he's much better at getting past people than you expect him to be. So you have him. You have the prospect of Ndombele getting fully settled. You have the aforementioned Kvaradona, who's just phenomenally fun to watch. There's so many good vibes in this team. Like, for neutrals listening who are sort of Serie A curious, maybe not Serie A fans, but Serie A curious, just book in some quality time with Napoli. They're a fun team to watch.
This is a bad point for me to say. I don't think they can actually win the league.
If they
finish top four, I think it's a huge success given what happened pre-season. I actually think, to be horribly realistic, now is about creating the distance between themselves and Juventus before Pogba and Chiesa come back later in the season.
But why do you conclude that they're not going to win the league?
Because we've got a small sample size of the form that proves they might be able to. I have doubts whether they can sustain it over the season. Yep. But I would be happy to be proved wrong.
I think I laid like the mother of all jinxes on Napoli a few years ago. I don't know if you remember.
I've been through it all. It can't get any worse.
No, but that year under Sarri, when it looked like they were going to do it, you know, and Koulibaly scored that late header against Juventus. And they were what? They were 1 point behind with four matches left. Juventus were wobbling. Their fixture list looked okay. I remember the night Koulibaly scored that header, I was just sat in the kitchen. I was thinking, they're going to do it, aren't they? So I went and I booked the flights and I got the Airbnb to make sure I was like in Naples for the last game of the season. And like a few days later, they immediately chucked away some points to Fiorentina. And it became clear that this wasn't going to happen after all. And I think that was to do with me. I think there's nothing to do with the 11 players on the pitch.
Hang your head in shame.
I've ruined it for all of Naples. Yeah. So sorry, guys.
They haven't forgiven you.
I'm not going to say anything more nice about you.
Yeah, I heard that they've got decent pizzas there, but they're not going to.
It's a great trip. It was very sad that they didn't win, obviously.
because of you.
You know, everyone knew Sarri was leaving, so it was quite an emotional game to be at anyway. And I ate some great pizza. The weather was nice.
Okay, we talked about metronomes. We've talked about enigmatic players. We've talked about dribbling. So I want to come back to that in just a moment because of this question by Dan on Twitter. And you can get in touch with us anytime during the course of the week at Football Ramble, at Dotson Adebayo, at Andy Brassel, and at Lars Severston. This from Dan on Twitter: why are Udinese so good this year? And may I add to that, is it because of a great dribbler that Everton didn't know what they had in him?
Well, Delafeu has been great this year, and he was particularly great against Inter, who could not deal with him at all. Inter actually took the lead in this game, but in the second half, they were panelled. They were so good, Udinese. Remember, they've already beat Roma 4-0 this season, going back to Dan's question. They're one of three teams to be top over the weekend in Italy, Atalanta being the other. I think Delafeu is a huge part of it, though he was great last season. But this is the best Udinese since the Guidolin years. And I think there are other players who are a huge part of that. Of course, Beto has scored a lot of goals at the start of this season. I think Sandy Lovric in midfield, the Slovenian, one for your Norwegians to look out for, Lars. Mm. I think he is a player who had a terrific second half against Juventus. You know, there's a lot of talent there. Again, I'm not sure how sustainable it is, a little bit like Napoli, but to be enjoyed at the moment. And it's not just that they're beating good teams, it's that they're really whacking them as well.
3-1. Yeah. Goodness gracious. And if you saw, Lars, the celebration from Delafeu for the third goal, it was like, and it was a corner. It was a corner.
Yeah.
A set piece, you know, you would have thought that could be defended. But Delafeu, and he was always somewhat enigmatic. He was never or ever part of a squad, was he? He's one of those sort of idiosyncratic players that go off and celebrate on their own. But he celebrated almost as if he had scored the goal. And okay, he was central to scoring the goal, but you just thought, oh, he's got a point. He's got every right to be celebrating like that.
Yeah, with Udinese, same colours, different vibe. With Udinese, generally speaking, you're maybe not. Maybe you should never be. I mean, most seasons they kind of just rattle along in the lower half of the table, and that's fine for a club of their size. But just they are a club who've shown over a number of years that they are very good at finding undervalued assets in the transfer market. Now, this has gotten harder over the last decade or so because the bigger clubs are smarter than they used to be. The Juventus were one of the clubs that got smart early and made quite a lot of money off of that. I think it's harder to find the gems now than it was 10 years ago. I think a lot of the bigger clubs with a lot of resources have wised up. But you should never be massively surprised when suddenly Udinese kind of come out of nowhere and are a better team than you expect them to be, because there's a lot of competent people involved with running that club.
I suppose in comparison to what's going on in Italy, what's going on at the top of the Spanish league, La Liga, is business as usual, isn't it? The top teams are where you'd expect them to be.
I guess people didn't really know quite what to expect from Barcelona at the start of the season. If we're talking about Real Madrid and their 100% record, they have gone from strength to strength after having, I guess, a sensible-ish window. Tchouaméni has obviously hit the ground running. But I think this win at Atletico Madrid was, firstly, an example of the distance between them and Atletico at the moment. And I think there is a considerable distance between them and Atletico at the moment. Secondly, I think it's an example that they can handle quite difficult situations. And thirdly, it was an example of Vinicius Junior at the peak of his powers. Of course, he suffered from racist abuse outside the ground, which was abhorrent. Inside the ground, from more than a small section of Atletico fans, it seemed. And that him and Rodrigo were able to help take Atletico apart, I think would have pleased more than a few neutrals on the night. It certainly pleased me. And I think what we've seen about Vinicius, we already knew, if we were paying attention, that he was not just a good player, but a man of substance, in that the way he dealt with this, you know, he's still so young. But, you know, Tim Vickery will tell you, came over with no real experience in first team football, with a €45 million price tag on him, simply because Real Madrid, I don't know if they ever really believed he could become this good, but they were scared of missing out on the next Neymar, just in case, after what had happened with that transfer. But I think to sort of not just match that sort of expectation, but like go above and beyond it and show that you're as impressive off the pitch as on it, I think is absolutely remarkable. Obviously, he's got his foundation. He does lots of good things for underprivileged and vulnerable people as well. And on the pitch, you know, he's one of the best players in the world at the moment.
You could argue that he won the Champions League for Real Madrid. But
he did in terms of the goal, didn't he?
Well, yeah. his colleagues might argue that they had something to do with it.
Yeah, they would.
But, Lars, how do you... Because Atletico have responded to the blatant racism that Vinicius suffered. But what do you make of the way that they've responded to that? Because it's not quite definitive, is it?
I feel like they're making the mistake that a lot of clubs make, in the sense that they want to serve their own audience. They want to serve their fans. They don't want to go against their own fans, but they also want to be seen to be doing and saying the right thing. Yeah. And sometimes that can be complicated. And this is the thing that frustrates me. I think clubs should be braver, and they shouldn't be afraid of saying, like, anyone who does anything or says anything like this are not welcome here. Like, we're embarrassed to be associated with you. Please go away and never come back. It should really be that simple.
I mean, they did say that.
But it's also...
It was quite non-specific, I think, the statement. And I think the elephant in the room here is the relationship with the main ultras group, Frente Atletico, because they've got a deserved reputation for... violence and for right-wing politics. I think, you know, we've seen, like, with some of their actions, even UEFA Youth League games, that some of their number are literal Nazis. You know, you can't get away from that with some of their actions. But the club have had plenty of opportunities to do something about it. If this is making them actually do something about it, great, but I won't believe it until I've seen it. And the thing is, like a lot of ultra groups, they're so deeply embedded in the club. I mean, we saw recently when Paulo Futre Atletico legend was taken ill, and the Frente Atletico wished him well after that. And he put a picture of himself on Twitter saying thanks to them for getting behind me and showing me the love and all the rest of it. And I was like, this is kind of problematic, isn't it? And then what happens a week and a half later shows exactly why it's so problematic. Unpicking that is an unenviable task for the club, but one that they have to be more proactive in dealing with.
Now, yes, and you're right, Andy, they did condemn it, but I think in this very long and convoluted statement they came out with, there's a part in it where, and I'm taking this, and I'm not really taking it out of context either, because you all know what the context is, but I want to read it, because the wording is, fans are asked for sanity and rationality, and yet, during the week, professionals from different fields generated an artificial campaign lighting the fuse of controversy without measuring the repercussions of their actions and manifestations, which references all the chat in Spanish media over the weekend over the subject of dancing and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
This is bollocks. Like, yeah. I'm sorry. There's a sort of an equivocation there that I'm not... This is... total nonsense. Mm. Just come out and say we're massively embarrassed to be associated with any of you dickheads who said or did anything like this. Full stop. You don't need anything else, right?
It doesn't
matter.
No.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Let's move on to the Bundesliga, where we're used to seeing Bayern at the top. But for a change, it's not Bayern at the top of the Bundesliga. It's a team that, well, a lot of people won't be that familiar with, Union Berlin. How have they managed to, well, to usurp Bayern from their normal position? Dortmund are there at number two, you know, second in the league, and we expect them to be there or thereabouts. But the issue is Bayern, isn't it? What's happened to them? They get beaten by Augsburg, and I think that was down to the goalie, Augsburg's goalie.
Rafał Gikiewicz, he was fantastic. And I think that the drama of it after Borussia's winner, right at the end, is the fifth minute of stoppage time. Manuel Neuer comes up for the corner, and straight away you're thinking, hang on, when are Bayern ever in a position where they have to put their goalkeeper up for a corner? This is not normal.
He's a good header of the ball, though. Don't knock him.
It turns out, yes. And Neuer nearly scored the equaliser. Kukovic made a fantastic save from him. And obviously, in a lot of the German press in the day or two afterwards, they pointed out that Neuer had more shots on target than Sadio Mane, which suggests a level of dysfunction. And of course, Mane hasn't scored for five games. Now, I tend to, like, without reverting too much to cliche, going back to form is temporary, class is permanent. Mm. But I think we can talk about form not just in terms of Vettel, but in terms of shape and in terms of the shape of the team, which Julian Nagelsmann, who is under pressure now, despite the fact they paid 25 million euros to get him out of RB Leipzig, that they gave him a big contract, and it would be heinously expensive to fire him if they were to take that course of action. I don't really get the impression they want to do that. Certainly not yet. There is question over him because, I mean, obviously, every time they lose a game at the moment, and this is their first defeat of the season, every time they don't win a game, because it's a four-game winless run in the Bundesliga, it all points back to a Lewandowski-shaped hole, especially on a weekend where he's scoring goals for Barcelona and he's been prolific in La Liga so far. But I think it's slightly more nuanced than that. It's not just about missing Lewandowski. Now, I think we saw in the early part of the season, they looked really free-flowing, Bayern. They were creating loads of chances, scoring loads of goals. They had this hybrid 4-4-2 with Gnabry and Mane at the tip of it. In the Champions League against Barcelona, they, as we were saying with Nicky last week, they played with Mane more on the left of a three, where we're more used to seeing him for Liverpool. But I think in the medium term, Nagelsmann is more suited without a number nine. And I think it's interesting that in the aftermath of this, both Oliver Kahn and the sporting director, Hasan Salihamidžić, have said, we're happy with the squad. We've got everything we need. We're not going to go out and buy a striker in January. And to be honest, I don't think they need to. If they'd have been taking their chances, and it is a remarkable sort of semi-dry spell that they've had, we'd be talking about something completely different. So I do think it takes time. But the thing is, Bayern are one of those clubs of such a size, a bit like Manchester United, I suppose, in a very different way, because Bayern are a lot more functional than them, that you can't have, Lars, a trust the process talk, can you? You know, you can't have a cold, dispassionate, nuanced discussion of what's actually going on.
Yeah, it's fine to trust the process as long as you're also winning every game.
Yeah.
Then the process can be trusted. If you're not winning four games in a row, you know, last time that happened was like 20 years ago, then obviously, you know, flags on half-mast all over Bavaria and you know, very dramatic scenes. I think it's interesting on a number of levels. It's interesting because I think this is the first time Julian Nagelsmann in his very short career as coach has been put under this amount of pressure and been put in this kind of situation. Obviously, he's wowed everyone with innovative tactical schemes and made his team play good football and stuff. But he's worked at Hoffenheim and Leipzig before, right? At RB Leipzig, if you lose a couple of games, no one cares. At Hoffenheim, if you lose a couple of games, no one notices. Like it doesn't matter. Whereas the pressure that's on him now from the media, from, you know, from external forces is tremendous. I mean, and he must know this. I thought the picture of them from Oktoberfest was absolutely amazing. If you haven't seen this yet,
go on, what is it? Describe it.
Well,
it's a contractual obligation.
Yes, I think he's on record saying he didn't want to go. Okay. But basically, it's a contractual thing for Bayern. They have to go to Oktoberfest, and obviously,
it's a drink up.
Yeah, which obviously, when you've not won in four games for the first time in like 20 years, you can't sit there and be happy in Oktoberfest. It'd be weird. So everyone's not very happy, and there is one picture in particular with him, with Oliver Kahn, with their wives and Hasan Salih, well, their partners, I should say, because Nagelsmann's not married, and Hasan Salihamidžić. So it's him and the two sort of big power brokers at the club, I suppose. and the mood is not good. The mood around the table is awkward because currently things are bad. And I think it's interesting with this Bayern team, having watched them in the Champions League and having watched them in the Bundesliga, it does occur to me that this is a team that's almost more suited to playing stronger opponents in the Champions League. Because what they've gone for with Lewandowski leaving and not replacing him with a typical number nine is that you have this sort of pretty fluid front line that you referenced. You have a lot of fast guys. I remember watching their game against Inter and just whenever they had a chance to attack, just the speed and the skill of the players who can run off into the distance, it's terrifying to play against. But that is less effective in the Bundesliga when most of the teams you play are going to sit on the back foot. You're not going to have acres of space to run into. You know, part of the genius of Lewandowski was that he's so good at finding space where there was none. Because most of Bayern's games domestically, they will have over 70% possession and they'll spend the most of the game trying to break down a packed defense. That is just the reality of most of their games domestically for Bayern. And having someone like Lewandowski, who was so good at just finding a little bit of space in the area, of getting in the end of crosses, you know, finding little openings, you know, that helped them a lot. And they have these sort of fast, you know, Mane is there, Sané is there, you know, Müller is still lurking around. I suppose he can do some of those things. But you don't have that sort of guy who, if you give him an inch in the box, he will punish you anymore. You have a lot of players who could feasibly score a lot of goals, but you don't have that killer. And yeah, they're creating chances, but you know, their XG numbers aren't actually looking that good. Quite a lot of those shots were either from bad areas or with lots of people in position to block. I think we'll see as the season goes on that they will thrive in the Champions League against teams that actually come up and open up and try to play against them. So you can run at them with all these little guys. But I think in terms of how to break down a packed defense and create quality chances when there's not a lot of space, that's something that needs to be worked on. And you mentioned, yeah, you're right. The Augsburg goalkeeper was really good. Jan Sommer was really good. But, you know, some of the finishes are not very... I mean, you go through... You know, they put out the Bundesliga. They put out the video of all the saves Jan Sommer made in that game. And a few of them were good. But, you know, a lot of them were straight at him.
Saves that he should have made, a lot of them.
I think they were. And It's the easiest thing in the world to say when you're having a slump and say, well, you know, if our forward had kicked the ball into the goal, everything would be much better. I mean, that goes for every team everywhere. I mean, that's fine. But they are creating a reasonable amount of chances. They are dominating the games. But I do think they need to work on schemes for unlocking these sort of packed defences, probably.
I think that the Lewandowski point you made there is a really interesting one. The fact that it's often overlooked, and I've said this before with him, that one of his key attributes is literally fighting defenders. He loves the physical side of it. He loves bullying defenders. He loves getting it and giving it back. And they don't have another player like that. As you say, with the others, it's about speed or it's about finding space. Or if, in the case of Müller, it's about guile. It's something different. I think the slightly overlooked thing is what Nagelsmann has to deal with in terms of the team composition. Now, I think those are all issues that can be overcome with the level of quality they've got. But I think what's the tricky thing for him, I mean, it's his own quote, actually, talk about being hoisted by your own petard, about it's him saying, like, being a head coach is like 15% tactics and 85% social competence. And for him, the difficulty is, with Lewandowski, you know exactly where you are, because like Harry Kane, he plays every single game. He doesn't rest. He's the guy who leads the attack. Everything else just fits around him.
Good comparison.
Whereas now, if you've got maybe 5-6 forwards of quality or wide forwards who can be played in a 4-4-2 or in the front of a 4-4-2 like they were at the start of the season or whatever, who all feel they should play, that is a different level of ego management, which I think now there's no definite starter apart from Mane. There is no definite starter next to him or around him. I think that is something totally different for Nagelsmann to deal with.
And there's an element of that in defense as well, where they also have, I mean, at the end of the day, Bayern Munich right now have more than 11 players who feel they should be starting every game.
Yeah.
And they have more than 11 players who have a pretty strong case for starting every game. And when you're winning every week, that's fine, because you can just tell them to shut up and go away. Like, we're winning every week. I don't care. Like, the team is fine. But the second you're not winning every week, suddenly the guys who are not starting will go, well, you know, start me. And it becomes complicated. And again, I'm not... Nagelsmann, I'm sure he's a very smart guy. He's a very confident young man. But I'm not sure how well life at Hoffenheim and Leipzig have necessarily prepared him for having to deal with that kind of situation. And I wonder if actually this is not just on Nagelsmann now. I wonder if this is when having... very successful ex-pros like Salihamidžić, like Oliver Kahn in the management structure, there could be some value in that because it shouldn't just actually be on Nagelsmann to settle people down if
they're new to it as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
It always is on the coach, isn't it? It's always is. You never get pressure on management. Well, you do to a certain extent, but rarely get pressure on the players. It's always, nearly always down to the coach. Andy's already mentioned that Nagelsmann is under pressure. And this tweet that we've got from Yardio, it echoes your point. Is Nagelsmann's job actually at risk? But this is the more salient part because, of course, when a manager's job is at risk or there's pressure on the management, then you look at the runners and riders to replace him. And one of the runners and riders is a name that many listeners will be familiar with, if not all listeners will be familiar with, and his name has come up in the mix, Thomas Tuchel. What can Tuchel bring to Bavaria is Yardio's salient point.
It would be a very different approach. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think in terms of what's actually on the pitch, if it were to get to that point where Tuchel were Bayern coach, I think the barbs about him being a purely defensive coach are unfair and incorrect. However, I think it would be a step down from the aesthetically pleasing game that Nagelsmann is moving towards. And that, post Van Gaal, post Heinkers, post Guardiola, it's a big deal at Bayern. To actually have a Bayern brand of football is important to them. I think the other thing is we've seen that I think he's answered a lot of questions at Chelsea in terms of how he can relate to the board, which a lot of people didn't feel he could do effectively before, that he can actually coach a team to winning a major trophy because his fingerprints are all over that Chelsea Champions League win, so his reputation is very different. But of course, he's still got a reputation in Germany for being a bit of a ball buster. And of course, for not lasting that long at clubs. They've invested long-term in Nagelsmann to take them to a place. Basically, it's about weathering this current storm so they can allow him to see through the long-term job that they want him to do. You know, I think at any other club, logic says he stays. But obviously, poor results are unsustainable at a club of this elite size.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Guardiola because there's a real sense that that kind of is the high watermark for the modern Bayern, the way they played in that period.
Yeah, it is.
And I think that's something that buys Nagelsmann some time and some patience from upstairs now, is that when they were good last season, went out to Villarreal in the Champions League and went out to Gladbach in the Cup, and that's all a bit disappointing. But when they were good in the league, when the team was functioning the way Nagelsmann wanted it to, they were hammering teams and dominating games and playing good football in a way they hadn't really seen it quite in the same way since Guardiola was there. And it seems to be that what he wants to move towards is something that's very much in keeping with that ambition.
Yeah, well, it seems like both of you are saying that Bayern are going to stick with Nagelsmann and Thomas Tuchel isn't really near taking over that job.
Well, I think the Tuchel-shaped shadow over him is quite unwelcome. It's bad timing him losing his job at Chelsea. It doesn't help, even though there's a lot to not recommend it. And I don't think it's their preferred option at the moment until he wins 10 games in a row convincingly. But it's not going to go away, is it?
There's another question from Callum on Twitter. At what point do we start getting excited by Union Berlin? They're top of the league.
I don't know. A year ago.
I don't know about you, Callum. I'm
excited for
about
a
them
long
already.
Time. So much excitement.
But do you believe in it?
I tell you what, I don't think top four's out of the question. It's early, and Urs Fischer, the coach, would never say that is a possibility. But I think the most interesting quote about them this season is from Manuel Neuer, where he said they're the toughest team we've played all season. And I think that's quite interesting. You know, that they have won games this season in a manner that you would consider worthy of buying. I think when they went and won 6-1 at Schalke, for example, the economy and the ruthlessness of that performance, the way that Fischer used the subs, I think is remarkable. They've got the best front two in the division at the moment in Jordan Sibachur, also known as Pefok, of course, and Geraldo Becker. And, you know, we talked before about like Tuchel and coaching. Fischer is an authentic coach. To get players to be better than they've been before, I think that's worth underlining.
Yeah, well, if you want to hear more about Union Berlin and their historic season, 2 weeks in a row, are they top of the league in the Bundesliga? If you want to hear more about their ascendancy, go listen to our latest episode of At The Match. Andy went to their first Europa League game of the season, by the way, taking in their legendary atmosphere and speaking to fans about what makes the club so special. So go find that in the Football Ramble feed. And by the way, one stat that I noticed, which is quite remarkable when you think about it, this match against Augsburg is the first time since 2020 that Bayern have failed to score in the Bundesliga. Remarkable. So just a final point, guys. Could you help us out? How on earth are we going to survive this international break?
By watching football.
Yeah, but what's the point of the Nations League?
It's good. It's a good tournament.
You can't do better than that.
Okay, well, this is going to be a party political broadcast on behalf of the Nations League party.
Go on, then.
But it's just, I just think it fulfills, concept good, timing bad is where I'm at with this. Conceptually, I think it works on a number of levels. I think it provides some of the weaker nations with competitive games that count against teams that are, closer to their strength level, which I think is very good for development. I don't think you develop a lot by getting thwacked by the bigger nations. I don't think that develops you at all, but I think playing more games against teams roughly your strength is better, and it does that. It provides an alternative route to qualification, which is an important thing for quite a few of the smaller nations, and for the sort of mid-ranked ones, like the country I'm from, it is an alternative route to a tournament, and it's also really important for your coefficient. And I know if you're English or German or from one of these big countries, you probably never had to care about the coefficient. But I think if you're from one of the other home nations or one of the sort of mid-ranking nations, you know that your coefficient is life in terms of getting to a tournament. What pot you come out of when the qualification groups are drawn is so unbelievably important. And we're doing well in the Nations League is a route to improving your standing there.
Yeah.
And so that matters. Whereas for the top teams, party political broadcast continues.
Cool. I didn't realize it
for
was
the bigger,
wasn't
for
over.
The thing never ends. For the bigger countries, you get the thing that people are always moaning about. They want more competitive games against other big countries. The Nations League delivers that. So conceptually, it ticks an awful lot of boxes.
See,
I think the problem is, but I think the problem is the last time we had Nations League games was in June. I remember it well. I saw it from the hospital. And there's a lot of, when everyone were really knackered and the players would rather have been on holiday, I think. And it was just a bad time to play a lot of international football. And now we have another batch coming now, just kind of as the season's getting going, with everyone kind of looking at the World Cup. So for the teams that are qualified for the World Cup, they can't help but use these as warm-up games to look at things. And the teams who are not in the World Cup, we kind of don't care because you're not in the World Cup, so who cares? So I think timing-wise, the last batch of games and this batch of games, I can completely see why people don't care about it. But I maintain that conceptually, and I'm going to say it again, the Nations League is conceptually sound and in the future will gain its rightful appreciation for being a good idea. And I hate to give you A for credit for anything, but
Andy,
I think it's a good idea.
Andy, you know your music. You know your music really well. Did you not groan each time a band came out with a conceptual album? Did you not? Oh, no!
Yeah, sorry, I thought you were going to say B-sides and rare cuts.
I don't mind them.
You're saying this is like a rock opera. This is the
it's the album that time forgot, the conceptual album.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm with Lars. I think it's a useful tournament, but it's like so much of international football, it's a victim of chronology, really. Because, I guess like people before would have said, we need more meaningful international football. And it has been provided. You know, it's reduced the amount of pointless friendlies. And God, I think all of us around this table have sat through enough pointless international friendlies to know that creating a plan to move on from that is a very good plan. And as Lars said, I think UEFA deserve credit for it. But of course, when it comes to international football, and you know, you go, here you go, here's your meaningful football. And you think, yeah, but not these matches, and not now. And you know, where do you put them? Yeah. It never comes back to the real problem in the timetable, which is that the club game is ridiculously overloaded, not taking care of player welfare, and really shortchanging the fans because they pay a fortune through getting into stadiums and TV subscriptions for often substandard product because there are simply too many matches in the calendar, something which is not going to change in the near future because elite level football is a huge cash cow. But I think here, when we talk about the chronology, I think a lot of even naysayers of the Nations League, once they got over the, I don't understand the format, well, pay attention to the format for more than a minute and you might get it.
Of course.
I think the first edition broke down a lot of those prejudices. And people thought, oh, this is actually a good thing. And I think we saw it with England, for example. You know, when they got to the final four of the first one, I remember the match where they went through. I was at it doing one of the early at the matches, actually, England versus Croatia. Full stadium, kept the buzz of the 2018 World Cup going. People cared. People wanted to win. England pushed to win in that game in the end. So the players cared. But, of course, the players and fans are only human. And the fact is, COVID changed all of this. Because, as we said, football couldn't take a step back and realise what was good for it. It couldn't say, we've got to deal with this timetable. It said, let's get the show back on the road by cramming the same amount of football in less time. And so you've got a sense where two seasons practically mold into one, where player welfare is completely off the menu, that people don't really care about that. So players aren't onside, fans aren't onside because it seems like overkill. And that really is the problem. I mean, in terms of his relationship to qualifying, like Lars was saying, I think it's really important. And that suggests it won't go away anytime soon.
But
as
does
well.
It have a UEFA future gonna... that is recognisable today? Because they're already inviting South American clubs to join in, what, 2 years' time?
Yeah, I think there has to be a future for it. But I think it's the way we look at the game, the way we perceive the game, the way the players are treated, that are all super important in this. And as Lars was saying, the scheduling. Because the experiment with these international breaks where you have three games, I mean, it's meant to basically not break up the club game too much. But, you know, I think that feels long to the players. It feels long to the fans. I think there are other issues other than the Nations League that need to be addressed. But the Nations League is taking the brunt of it.
It's time to ask you both to recommend a game of the week for us to watch. I imagine that your suggestions would be dominated by the Nations League. Lars, do you want to go first?
I'm going to be slightly more flippant than Andy, which is obviously very unusual for me.
Yes, very, very unusual.
But listen, I've just talked about how you might think the Nations League is a load of old nonsense. But for some countries, it really matters. And it happens to be that for one of those countries, it's my country, it's Norway. For Norway, it does actually matter. Because if I'm not completely mistaken, obviously, if we win our group, we're in on the second tier. We're in League B. If we have a real shot at winning our group, we're topping the group now. We're undefeated after four games. And we're in group with Serbia, Sweden and Slovenia. If we win the group, obviously, we go to Group A, which is kind of fun and groovy. But almost more importantly, we move into pot two, I believe, for the next qualifier, which makes a really big difference in terms of getting to a tournament. So this is important for us, these two games. And the first one is against Slovenia now this weekend. You know, you might not think Slovenia and Norway is how we want to spend your weekend, but you know, hey, it's going to be Erling Haaland versus Jan Oblak. What's not to like?
And so Slovenia is a very beautiful country anyway, isn't it?
Obviously.
Yeah, not as beautiful as Norway, though.
No. Also, obviously.
Battle of the Beautifuls.
Yeah, indeed.
It's Erling Haaland. It's the ice troll versus the occasionally best shot stopper in the world, Jan Oblak.
And are we
what
to,
more do you want?
What more
some
we
lute
want?
Some lutefisk.
Exactly, some lutefisk to go with
Bring
this.
It on.
Do you know the lutefisk?
No.
Well,
I'm listening.
Yeah. Do you not watch the advert?
I don't think we have that kind of time.
Do you not watch the advert? Gravlax! Gravlax!
It's a good advert.
It's a good advert, except the bloke's Norwegian, not Swedish.
In the advert?
Yeah.
I think he sounds pretty Swedish.
Well, it sounds Swedish from the side of Sweden.
So, lutefisk is made from aged stockfish or dried salted cod, which is cured in lye.
Yep.
Okay. As you do.
We eat
it's gelatinous in texture after being rehydrated for days prior to eating.
Do you know, it's a delicacy in Nigeria in a different way. In a different way, yeah. We call it
days.
Banla, the dried... anyway, we'll come to that another time because, Andy, you've got a game of the week for us as well.
Yeah, I have, and you're going to have to be quick to catch this one because it's Thursday night. It's not a top-of-the-table clash like Lars's, so not quite as glamorous. It's a relegation battle in the Nations League between France and Austria. And we said how, you know, a lot of people have felt like they want to tap out of the Nations League. Well, this does matter to France, not in terms of the actual tournament itself, of course, because they can't get in the Final Four anyway after quite a poor start, which has incorporated two defeats at the Stade de France, but because they've had quite a turbulent time with scandal at the French Football Federation, with the Pogba affair, with a ton of injuries, with the way that the last Euros ended and the shape of the team since, the tactical shape of the team. So they need to get some stuff together and they need to try out some fringe players, Benoit Badiashile being one, Youssef Fofana, also Monaco being another. There is an opportunity for some of those players because, of course, they have expanded squads of 26 going into the World Cup. They haven't got much time to get it right. And I think France are quite short of where they should be for the World Cup. So I do think that's an issue. Interestingly, this sort of scratch defence is going to be up against two really informed but not necessarily glamorous strikers in Marko Arnautović, who started the season on fire for Bologna, and Michael Gregoric, who's started really well for Freiburg. So there's the potential for embarrassment there. So therefore, I think we're going to go French for the food, of course.
Let's
now,
go.
One thing that I learned in France is it's very important to have your steak rare. And of course, France looking a little bit underdone at the moment.
Oh my God. Potential for embarrassment indeed.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.